Starbucks shuts it down for a day. The IMF says the economy's good for now. And look, think twice before you bail on that dinner reservation, will ya? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 17th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the latest entry in Corporate America Tries to Deal with a Public Relations Disaster in the Era of Social Media file. Starbucks announced today it's going to close all 8,000 of its company-owned stores, about 175,000 workers, for a day on May 29th. For racial bias training. This follows, of course, the incident at a Starbucks in Philadelphia where two black men were arrested after the manager called police because the two were sitting in the store without buying a drink. Bloomberg's Leslie Patton has been following this story today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This seems like a fairly strong brand preservation play by Kevin Johnson, the CEO of Starbucks. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a PR move, and it's also a move for the business to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen again. I mean, closing stores is obviously bad for sales and will hurt that figure, their comp sales and revenue figures, and you know, when they report this quarter. But it's also important for them to figure out how to make sure this type of thing doesn't happen.
It seems to me the company is trying to thread a pretty small needle here of, as they have said a zillion times, being a public space, a third space where people can go, but also a private company.
That's what a lot of these restaurants face. I mean, I think McDonald's faces this sort of thing probably too. I mean, these are places that are open to the public where people can just go in and sit down, maybe use the bathroom. But at the same time, they're also trying to provide a certain atmosphere and make it comfortable for people who are buying things.
Yeah. One of the problems, it seems to me, that Mr. Johnson and the company are going to have is a lack of uniformity across the 8,000 company-owned stores and who knows how many franchises that are out there. I mean, I can go to my Starbucks and yes, look, I'm a white guy, and that factors into this whole thing. But I can go to my Starbucks and sit around for a while. Maybe a Starbucks someplace else, that might not be cool.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think this probably differs across the country. There's probably bias based on, you know, a lot of different things, not just race, as in this case, but probably a lot of different issues.
What do you think the end result of this thing is? He has this shutdown, the safety stand down, we used to call it in the Navy, Mr. Johnson does, for 8,000 stores on a day. What next does he have to do after that? Because it seems to me this can't be the end of it.
Yeah, definitely not. And you know, I think the company probably realizes that, too. And for the large part, they've been really proactive in reaching out to different communities and opening stores in low-income areas. But they're going to have to continue to do that and give everyone updates. And they're going to be held accountable to see if this is actually happening.
Leslie Patton, she covers restaurants, and Starbucks is included in that for Bloomberg. We got her, as you can probably hear, in the Bloomberg newsroom in Chicago. Leslie, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you.
Starbucks shares today, for the curious among you, up about 0.7%. President Trump is meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe this week. Trade is among the issues on the table, specifically the president's steel and aluminum tariffs, and even more specifically, Japan's desire to be on the exempted list. Lots of other American allies, most of them actually, have been exempted. And American companies that import steel and aluminum want out, too. In the month or so since the tariffs were announced, the Department of Commerce has received about 2,200 corporate exemption applications. MarketPlace's Tracy Samuelson looks at who's trying to get out from under.
Richard Foster makes these mechanized dampers or louvers that go in heating and cooling ducts. They open and close to help control the temperature. And he's still trying to get his head around the cost of these tariffs for his company, Zone First, in New Jersey.
The bigger issue for us is as the damper gets bigger, the price goes up even more.
He uses both steel and aluminum and says the amount of metal he needs changes depending on the size of the product.
I have to look at each size almost individually because a little 6-inch round damper is not going to go up as much as a 20-inch round damper.
Would he like an exemption from these tariffs? Sure. But he hasn't applied for one and doesn't know how the process works. He's going to look into it. So even while Commerce has received about 2,200 applications for exemptions so far, there are probably lots more to come.
Definitely lots of interest.
Lars Hjelm is a lawyer with Akin Gump. He says companies have the best chance if they can prove that they can't get the products they want to import in the U.S.
Showing the lack of an available quantity and sufficient quality in the U.S. market is the main challenge.
Before an application can be approved, it has to be posted publicly for comment. So far, Commerce has posted less than 5% of applications it's received.
So it appears that we've generated an immense backlog when the process has barely started.
Greg Hussisian, a trade lawyer with the law firm Foley & Lardner. Commerce says it's reviewing applications to make sure they're complete and filled out correctly. Hussisian thinks that's part of the holdup.
The more likely explanation, however, is that the agency is just overwhelmed.
He thinks they didn't have the staff in place to be able to review all of these applications. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, trade war? What trade war? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Larry Kudlow, the president's new-ish chief economic advisor, said something interesting on Fox News today in the course of a conversation about his boss's tax cuts and the overall state of the American economy. Here you go.
You know, I'm old-fashioned. I'm a JFK tax cutter. I'm a Ronald Reagan tax cutter. A rising tide lifts all boats. We are starting to see an economic boom.
It's worth a mention here on that boom thing that the American economy has been growing for almost 9 straight years now. But Mr. Kudlow's comments are a good jumping off point for news out of the International Monetary Fund this morning. The IMF figures the global economy is going to grow at a rate of 3.9% this year, and it bumped its growth target for this economy, the U.S. economy, to 2.9%, oh so very close to the 3% forecast the Trump administration has been promising. We've called Kathy Bosjancic. She's the chief U.S. financial markets economist at Oxford Economics to get a little context on this. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What do you make of this IMF forecast, first of all?
Well, not surprising that they revised up their forecast across the globe. It reflects strong underlying economic activity and momentum that should carry into 2018. In addition to that, it incorporates a fiscal stimulus from the U.S., so mm-hmm. in the form of both tax cuts and additional spending.
Well, let me ask you about, since you brought it back to the States, let me ask you about the tax cuts and the spending. We're spending a whole lot of money. We're adding to the deficit. We're going to get this short-term bump. Will it last? Is it a sugar high or is it for real?
That's the key question. Many economists, including ourselves, debating that. And the Federal Reserve, by the way, openly debating and wondering about it. It does boost growth, we think, in the short term for 2018-19. We're skeptical that it has much of a long-lasting impact beyond that, though.
You mentioned the Fed. I'll pick up on the minutes of their most recent meeting. They said they were concerned about the increased debt load, the deficit that these things add. How, in the long term, how bad is that additional deficit that we're piling on, $1 trillion a year?
Well, it is additional debt and borrowing that needs to take place in addition to what was already a bad situation. Yeah. So it just made a bad situation even worse. There's no doubt about that.
Step back for me, would you, Kathy, and talk about the forces acting in the global economy, right? Because we've got these stimuli going in the United States. What's driving the rest of the world, and can the rest of the world keep it up?
So about 18 months ago, China's growth started to slow a little bit, and the Chinese authorities initiated their own form of stimulus. Mm-hmm. It stimulated the Chinese economy, and that had some positive ripple effects throughout the globe, particularly with Europe. So we finally saw the Eurozone outperforming and was red hot, the growth rate about 2.4%. That's probably more than double their underlying potential growth rate. Hmm. We contrast that with the U.S. The U.S. underlying potential growth rate is about 1.8%.
Whoa, say that again. 1. How many percent?
1.8% is the underlying potential growth rate for the U.S.
What does that mean?
So it means, what is the best we can do in the long run on a sustained basis? We're at full employment and low inflation.
Let me throw a global trade four-letter word at you and get your reaction as it relates to global economic growth. Tariff, which I know isn't a four-letter word.
Right. It is a bad word, though, for most economists. It tends to retard global trade and global economic activity, and eventually is actually negative for even productivity growth.
All right, spitball this for me then. And I get that you're not a political prognosticator, but what do you think happens with the tariffs and the talk of trade wars?
There's a lot of uncertainty around, you know, what plays out. What we have seen is that even the threat of tariffs and increased protectionism has had an adverse effect on a number of economic data points, particularly business and consumer confidence.
Kathy Bosjancic, she's at Oxford Economics. Kathy, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure. Kai, thank you.
Last November, President Trump decided to end what's known as temporary protected status for about 50,000 Haitians living and working in this economy. Status that they got after the 2010 earthquake that so badly damaged Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and its economy. That decision means those 50,000 people have until July of next year to basically wrap up their affairs here. According to the Center for Migration Studies of New York, 81% of Haitians with TPS are part of the American labor force, and that they support family members still in Haiti with monthly remittances. They go home, that money goes away, and then what? Marketplace's Renata Sago reports.
There's a small office building on Orlando's west side that's fairly inconspicuous except for a yellow sign with the letter CAM. That's short for Caribbean Airmail. The popular wire service has agencies in Haitian beauty salons, bakeries, and office buildings like this one. Renal Justance comes here at least once a week. He walks up to the counter with a $50 bill in his hand.
We are making a small transfer, Port-au-Prince.
This is Justance's second day in a row here. His brother-in-law in Haiti called that morning saying he needed cash, so Justance is sending $50.
He is very important to me. He's my wife's older brother. He's older than my wife. He doesn't have a job. That is why I have to support.
Justance earns his living working in the kitchen at Disney World. He arrived in Orlando on a U.S. military airlift just days after the earthquake hit Haiti. The 47-year-old lives with his wife, son, and daughter.
I have a lot of family in Haiti. I have a kid, I have my mother, I have my sister in Haiti, I have friends in Haiti. That is why I send money to Haiti, just to support all these people.
According to the World Bank, remittances from Haitians in the U.S. contribute to 29% of Haiti's gross domestic product. Stephanie Seguino teaches economics at the University of Vermont.
If we look at remittances from the U.S. to Haiti, they're more than half of all remittances that go to Haiti, so maybe $1.3 billion.
So, she says, if more than 50,000 Haitians have to leave the U.S. because their temporary protected status is revoked,
it's going to create ever more hardship in a country that is already desperately, desperately poor.
Norluc d'Orange offers a wide range of financial services to Haitians in Orlando, including a way to wire cash to the island. He says many clients want to send money for food.
Someone can call a friend or a family member and say, I have nothing to put in my mouth, so my belly is empty, so do something.
Some clients send as little as $15, which, with the exchange rate, can help a lot of people there.
People can go to the open-air market and shopping for food for 2 days for five people.
The Trump administration says the program should end for Haitians because conditions on the island are better than they were when the earthquake hit. And D'Orange says a drop in remittance money might force the Haitian government to deal with long-standing issues such as high unemployment and low agricultural production. But the country's weak economy is what forced many Haitians to come to the United States in the first place. That's according to Dr. Idlo Banam, who heads Orlando's Haitian American Chamber of Commerce. He says Haitians who now have jobs and pay taxes in the U.S. don't understand why they may need to leave.
That's the hard part for individuals to kind of accept. Why the discontinuation so suddenly when I'm contributing, it's not a burden.
Renal Justons, who sends money back at least once a week, says he fears what will happen if he has to leave the country. He and his wife have temporary protected status. Their kids are U.S. citizens. He could be split from his family again.
If a final decision is taken to return us to Haiti, it would be like another earthquake.
Some members of Congress are calling for Haitians with temporary protected status to receive permanent residency. But for now, the program's scheduled to end in July of 2019. In Orlando, I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Restaurants we somehow treat as this field of entertainment where we can just be casual and blow them off.
Well, yeah, but that don't make it right. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 213 points today, about 0.8%, ended at 24,786. The NASDAQ up 124, 1.7%, closed at 7,281. The S&P 500 gained 28 points, 1% on the nose, 2,706. Electric car maker Tesla slowed 1.2% today. The automaker said it was temporarily halting production of its Model 3 sedan. Oops. On a happier note, though, China has announced it's going to lift certain restrictions on ownership for foreign auto companies. Tesla will stand to gain from that. Also, General Motors will up 0.1%, and Ford closed unchanged today. Netflix reported results today. The moving streaming service, Movie streaming service, brightened 9.1%, gained more than 7 million subscribers in the first quarter, more than analysts or probably maybe even the company had expected. You're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. You'll reap the rewards every time you listen, knowing that you're helping Marketplace make people smarter about the economy and why it matters. And don't forget, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar when you give today, thanks to a generous challenge from our friends at Candida. Now's the time, folks. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift to become a Marketplace investor today.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Taxes are on a lot of people's minds today, the filing thereof. I, however, am just going to go ahead and guess Supreme Court justices aren't going to be sitting home tonight beavering away at TurboTax, which is good because they spent a good amount of brain power today thinking about sales tax. And docket number 17-494, South Dakota v. Wayfair, Inc. At issue, whether online retailers should have to collect sales tax in all 50 states. I'm sure there's a constitutional issue buried in this case somewhere, but I'm going to speak economic journalist for a second. What is this case really all about? Following the money. Billions and billions of money. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Let's say I go to Etsy.com and buy an $80 Turkish geometric handwoven rug. On the checkout screen, right next to the word sales tax, it reads $0.00. That's because the seller doesn't have a physical presence here in California. States, they want that money.
Red state, blue state, big state, small state. That's like a Dr. Seuss saying, but...
Max Belke is director of tax policy with the National Conference of State Legislatures. He says if states could collect sales tax from all online purchases...
It means long-term revenue certainty that they don't have right now.
And it's overdue, says Illinois State Senator Pamela Althoff.
Legislation needs to follow the trends of our consumers, and for 26 years, we've not been doing that.
Althoff says her state is losing out on roughly $750 million a year.
More money to education. It means more money for our human services.
She says state agencies have seen their budgets shrink year after year. And when it comes to those kind of money problems, Illinois has lots of company. Estimates vary, but John Buell of the Tax Foundation says overall, states are losing out on up to $13 billion a year.
States really want the revenue, which is understandable.
But, he says,
they're not really thinking about the actual burden that these types of rules can impose on a national economy.
He says there are more than 10,000 sales tax jurisdictions in the country. It's so complicated that even a Twix and Snickers bar can be taxed differently in some states. Software can do some of that work, but
it's a lot more difficult to figure this stuff out than maybe some of the groups on the sides of the states are really trying to make it out to be.
Buell says complying with a lot of new rules and rates could be especially burdensome and costly for small businesses. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
There you are, trying to figure out what to have for dinner. You decide maybe you'll go out instead. You pull out your phone, you fire up your favorite reservation app, and boom, most of the time, you're done. Easy for you, not always the same experience on the restaurant side, and most of the time, that is our fault. Marissa Conrad wrote at Grub Street not too long ago about how bad, I guess, the dining public is at that whole eating out thing. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So here's something I didn't quite realize until I read this article, that these reservation services, we, the diner, we are not the actual customers of these things.
That's 100% true. So as a diner, you know, you're opening a restaurant reservation platform like OpenTable or one of the newer ones, Resy or Reserve, you're booking. But, you know, on the restaurant side, they're looking for a restaurant reservation platform that can also help them manage their dining room. You know, shuffle people if someone cancels at the last second or doesn't show up, you know, there's all this behind-the-scenes technology, you know, on their back end that helps them shuffle. So they're looking for the platform that can do that the best for them.
Yeah, and going out to eat for us is relatively simple, made easier now by these platforms. It is immensely challenging for these restaurants, managing all of us, you know, lousy diners and reservation people.
It's insane. So to report this story, I shadowed Saturday night at a few popular restaurants in New York. You know, they start the night with this very careful plan of they know who's coming in, they know exactly where everyone's going to sit, and then they watch it all unravel as someone doesn't show up or someone comes with an extra friend thinking, oh, I can squeeze my friend in.
Which goes to the sort of the subhead of this, or the actual title of this article, which is we suck at reservations. That we being you and me in the dining public, right? We're just terrible to these restaurants.
Yes, we really are. And I think it's just an interesting field that people don't realize. You know, you book a ticket to the theater.
Right,
and you've prepaid for that ticket, and that incentivizes you to show up at the theater. But restaurants, we somehow treat as this field of entertainment where we can just be casual and blow them off.
So talk to me for a second before we get into the machinations of this. Talk to me about it's basically a tech competition now, right? You've got OpenTable, which is kind of the granddaddy. It's been around for like 20-something years. But there's a whole new stream of, what was your phrase, restaurant reservation platforms that are now coming online?
Yeah, so OpenTable was founded in 1998, and it has just been, you know, you book a restaurant online, you're doing it on OpenTable.
Yeah.
And that was how it went until about 2015 when a few newcomers came onto the stage. And, you know, right now I think we're hitting the peak point where they're not startups anymore. They are on the field. And there's Resy, there's Reserve, and then there's one called Talk, which I think actually is the most interesting of them all because it asks you to prepay for your meal.
Wow.
Or at least put down some kind of deposit. So you might put down $20 to reserve your seat, and then that's taken off your check at the end of the meal.
Right.
But if you don't show up, you lose that $20.
Which makes sense, right? You don't show up at the at the theater for a Broadway show, you're losing your theater, right? You're losing your seat.
Exactly.
Do these platforms, do they work for restaurants? Are the restaurants basically happy with the service they're getting from whichever platform they're on?
You know, when you talk to restaurants, you hear a wide range of feelings and opinions on all of these platforms. You know, some restaurants were frustrated with the fee structure of OpenTable and did not like paying, you know, the $1 per diner. But other restaurants said they still thought that cost was worth it because it's, you know, advertising dollars, essentially.
Yeah.
But then other restaurants that perhaps are a little newer, hotter, they don't necessarily need that discovery element that OpenTable gives. And so they can, you know, go on to a resi or a reserve and trust that the consumers will follow.
Marissa Conrad, running on food and a bunch of other stuff at Grub Street, most recently on how we are just so bad at reservations. Marissa, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a sidebar to the Southwest Airlines flight today that had that engine failure. One woman, according to the National Transportation Safety Board, has died in the incident. The first fatality on an American airline in 9 years. And I want to play a piece of tape right now that might help explain why. It's part of the recording of the air traffic control radio transmissions to the plane during the accident. The plane is call sign Southwest 1380. The first voice you're going to hear is the controller on the ground.
Southwest 1380. I understand your emergency. Let me know when you want to go in.
Yeah, we have a part of the aircraft missing, so we're going to need to slow down a bit.
Southwest 1380, speed is your discretion. Maintain at any altitude above 3,000 feet.
Southwest 1380, you'd like to turn, start turning inbound.
We have a part of the aircraft missing. Calm and professional on both ends of that conversation. Okay, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 213 today, about 0.8%. NASDAQ up 124 points, 1.7%. S&P 500 gained 28 points, about 1% there. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.